Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect welcomes Michael McMillan, former executive chair of Alliance Atlantis Media and co-founder of Samara Canada, to talk about his time with a food hamper from the Stop Community Food Center and how it affected his life while he was on it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here. I guess even before I describe the reactions, almost the most important thing to point out is that it was a PR stunt, you know. I mean, none of us were under any illusion that we were going to find out what it was really like to be on welfare.
Right.
And, you know, 7 days is not an accurate picture. It was an activity designed to draw attention to the plight of those on social assistance, and we can't really leave. I couldn't leave my happy bourgeois life behind in 7 days and really get an accurate picture. So that's got to be, you know, made clear right up front that this is only a slight passing glimpse. Having said that, the response that I had was pretty much like the others too. You know, after 4 or 5 days eating what one would be able to eat on welfare, we all became not only hungry but more surprisingly irritated and irritable.
And tired
and sluggish and couldn't really think straight.
Well.
And so the impact of eating a diet that was low on fruits and veggies and low on quality protein was pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, I remember discussing with Jonah Shine at the Stop how this exercise was playing out, and it wasn't getting a lot of press, although a lot of people were trying it, and there was some question as to the impact it was having, but it had been going on for a year. And I'm very pleased to see this experiment, and I understand that it can't replicate life on social assistance, but it can replicate life on a food hamper, which is only meant to last 3 or 4 days, and that's assuming that you're replicating the eating habits, I guess, of someone who's run out of food towards the very end of the month and has gone to the food bank or the community food center at the Stop and gotten something to get you through. You also mentioned that you were something of a cook. Have you been a foodie for a while?
Yeah, I am a very keen cook. I cook every day, and virtually every day, and I'm good at it, and I enjoy it, and that's why I do it all the time. And I've always fancied that I could, and generally I am able to make a very nice meal out of not a lot.
All right.
If I need to. Turns out that I never really understood what not a lot was until last
Sorry.
Week.
Yeah.
You know, and the lack of variety, the heaviness or the preponderance of
carbs
and including some processed carbs like processed oatmeal and like instant oatmeal and that kind of stuff is not a selection of foods that I would ordinarily make. So it was difficult to make appetizing, let alone healthy meals if one basically had carbs and not a lot of fruits and veggies and not a lot of, you know, good protein.
When was the last time that you yourself would have, as a student or in whatever situation, would have embraced Kraft dinner as food?
I've never really embraced Kraft dinner as food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a student, I ate, in hindsight, probably poorly. But
right.
By hook or by crook, I always was able to, and I guess wanted to eat fruits and vegetables.
Right.
So, you know, I've never been a Kraft dinner person.
Okay.
But on the other hand, even as a student, lo, those many years ago, I always had more than the equivalent of the current $4.50 a day, mm-hmm. or whatever it is that those on welfare get. You
mm-hmm.
know, I mean, the point of this exercise is that the welfare payment of $590 a month includes a portion that's allocated specifically for rent,
yeah.
about $360, and that's mm-hmm. for rent only. And if you save on that through some miracle, you can't allocate it to something else.
Yeah, and basically the going rate for a room is about $400, isn't it? And
well,
up?
I suppose probably more than that.
Yeah.
So, but whatever it is, that amount is put for rent. If one then takes off the cost of a Metro Pass, a TTC Metro Pass in Toronto, for example.
It's over 100 now, isn't it?
115 or something like that.
Yeah.
One's left with about $115 for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So think about that, you know, $4 a day, basically,
mm-hmm.
for everything,
mm-hmm.
for food, for clothing, for, you know, medical stuff, drugs, for everything,
yeah.
for $4 a day. And the Medical Officer of Health of Toronto and most big cities in Ontario put out an annual statement whereby they politely yell at us and say, here's what every individual in Ontario ought to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Some fruits and veggies and so on, and the minimum to stay alive healthily would cost $8 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I spend more than that on food, and I bet you do too.
Yeah.
But the minimum for a proper intake of food to be alive and healthy, $8 a day. So when we only
this comes from the medical officers of health,
yes,
in major cities.
Yep.
Okay.
And in fact, Dr. David McEwen, who's the Toronto Medical Officer of Health, went on this welfare diet with us.
Oh, I see that. He lost 5 pounds.
Yeah. And so his advice is we have to spend at least $8 a day for this minimum safety of food.
And that doesn't include eating out or
no.
social eating.
That's right.
Yeah.
It includes no booze, no restaurants. Well, it includes all the food you get take in, but you could have one meal out for that.
Yeah.
Is it little wonder that on $4 a day,
mm-hmm.
which is all the money in total available for a welfare recipient after rent and after a Metro Pass, well,
mm-hmm.
you know, duh, it doesn't add up. It's not possible to eat
McEwen,
a healthy diet.
McEwen's quoted here, in work settings, family settings with friends, I couldn't join in with the food that was part of the events, so there's a sense of isolation that you get when you're not able to be a part of what others who have more resources are enjoying. And, of course, in this situation, almost everybody has more resources, so you can't be a part of almost any event.
No, that's right. You're isolated, and you end up staying at home, not participating. And what's the purpose of giving somebody a welfare support? Presumably, not to kick them when they're down,
right.
but to help them get up
yeah.
and have them, you know, tide them through so they can find the job and restore the dignity that they once had, become a working member of society again, ideally sooner and not later. And if your entire budget, apart from rent and transit, is $4 a day, it's not going to be very easy to do that, to find that job, to be part of a dignified social, you know, setting with one's family and friends. And I certainly found that.
Yeah.
It was impossible. In fact, when I finally fell off the wagon, as they say, on my fifth day, I had run out of food, and I was run down, and I couldn't think straight, and I was really, you know, irritated with the whole thing. But I went back onto my regular diet after that, and I had three oranges and an apple and a bunch of leftover cooked vegetables that my family had in the fridge. And within a day, I felt better.
Yeah.
And it was a direct response to eating, you know, a healthy intake of food. So it is kind of weird that we expect those on welfare to survive on something that the medical officer of health says is impossible and unhealthy.
And also seems emotionally unhealthy as well.
Yeah. And Dr. McEwen provided us with some interesting statistics about how the use of the health care system is much greater by those in poverty.
Yeah, so we're using it as an interventionist system rather than a maintenance or preventive system.
Yeah.
And that's so expensive as anybody
very
knows.
Very expensive.
Yeah.
So it's a curious, even if one had, you know, a draconian Dark Ages view on the poor, it still wouldn't make sense.
Because you would save money by treating them better.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it was started back in the early 90s by Mike Harris, who decided that a lot of people were cheating welfare, and he was going to move the rate down low enough that you couldn't live on welfare to encourage people to get off. But I don't think anybody thought about this recession or people who face obstacles, such as people who are waiting to get on Ontario Disability Support and can't, you know, get a regular job for one reason or another. Mental problems, addiction problems. I can't begin to list all the reasons that people have difficulty getting back to work. And it would be nice if they had some help, as you said, instead of some more obstacles to put in their way.
I'm pretty sure that everybody on welfare wants to get off. You know, I mean, I can't see anybody saying, gee, I really want to be on welfare where the total money I have per day after shelter and transit is $4 for my entire budget. That's hardly a gravy train. That's hardly a lifestyle that anybody would wish for. And I must say, it upsets me a lot when people say, well, folks just like that welfare lifestyle. As Nick Saul, who runs the Stop Community Food Center in Toronto, says, there's very little life and absolutely no style
on
welfare. So this allegation that the poor are enjoying the lifestyle or somehow are morally lesser than the rest of us is a Dark Ages view on life that I would urge us all to push back against. So admittedly, the Harris government did cut back, and that was just a bloody shame that they did. But since then, the current government has not increased the payments in keeping with inflation. So they have, in fact,
declined
significantly compared to the necessities of life that the welfare payments are designed to try to partly cover, at least.
Yeah.
So there's lots of blame to go around all over the place. But those cuts back in the 90s under Harris were significant.
It seems they're going to take a while to recover from, too. I spoke with someone in the federal government about this, was it yesterday or today, and mentioned the protest in Queen's Park, and they said, they're, another protest to the wrong people, which won't achieve anything. And I said, what do you mean? You don't feel Queen's Park supports the budget for welfare? And he says, it's only 50%. He said the other 50% is municipal. And that was something I wasn't fully aware of. I knew a portion of it was municipal, but I had no idea it was a full 50%. So that the cities themselves seem to be complicit in this level of welfare, but it's a chicken and egg thing, right? I mean, city's not going to say, oh, we'll stand to 60% if they want to up it, right? The province has got to go along and the cities have got to go along. Neither one seems to be willing to discuss the issue.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, sadly, those who are welfare recipients don't exactly have a strong voice.
No, that's right.
It's not as if, most of us in society, when our issue is under attack, if we think that we're getting the short end of the stick, generally speaking, there is some voice for us through our community groups, through our employers, through our associations,
neighborhoods, you know, and other property owners. Yeah,
exactly. But those on welfare are, you know, unable by and large to have their views heard, and that's of course the great indignity of assuming that, well, that they won't speak up, they won't be able to, you know, protest for their basic human dignity and rights, and that's kind of the really frustrating part of this, and that's what attracted me to want to be part of this PR stunt to try and raise that voice.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that's behind the political stalemate on this issue, that poor people don't vote, or poor people move around, so I don't have to worry they'll be in someone else's riding or constituency or ward next time. I've often wondered about that, what the attitude to the poor is, because the poor have the same vote as anybody else, and they're increasingly politicized, as the Stop Community Food Center has shown. But no one seems to think that the vote of, I don't know how many people are on benefits, but I'll bet it's 500,000 anyway, in southern Ontario. No one seems to think that 500,000 votes seems to make any difference to them, personally or politically.
Yeah, and you know what? Even if the votes do make a difference or don't make a difference, one might consider what the individual human dignity of each one of those people, one by one, how much that matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd submit that matters, you know, completely.
Well, it happens that the individual I spoke to is someone living on Ontario Disability Support until the next week or so, and they got a government contract, and they're going to be running the equivalent of a small junior government ministry, because they've been doing this work for years, 7 years, without pay. And that gives you an idea of the caliber of people that we have on fixed incomes. I mean, they range all the way from people who belong on Ontario Disability Support because they can't take care of themselves, to people who are on Ontario Disability Support, who are at least as good as their counterparts in government, and the government recognizes that. And yet, you know, 7 years. 7 years, this guy living on $1,000 a month, doing the government's work. I still have a hard time putting that together. There seems to be an underestimation at the provincial and municipal level. The federal government seems to see, and I can share this with you and the listener, seems to see that a large part, or an important constituent part of dealing with our looming pension and seniors' debts as the baby boomers grow older, is to tap people with disabilities as an untaxed employment market, and that the federal government seems to see the need to support them and bring them into society and enable them to generate income, if only so that it can be taxed and we're not left with a problem like they've got in the States when the baby boomers retire.
Yeah.
Their baby boom, I think, is 5 years younger or older than ours for some reason I don't understand. Their baby boom started with a bang in about 1945, 46, and ours didn't really get rolling till the late 40s and 1950.
Actually, the largest the year of the greatest birth in Canada was 1962, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Which is much later than you would think.
Yeah, that'd be the very tail end of the baby.
Very sharply right after that, but in any event, you know, however one measures this, the boomers are numerous, and they're entering their retirement years shortly, and they will need to be looked after.
Yeah, and we need all these people at work who we're stomping on right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, I think that the this welfare diet that we did 10 days ago, I hope that it focuses the issue on the things we've just been discussing, and about the plight of those in poverty, our responsibility to treat them with dignity.
Yeah.
It's in our self-interest. It's unhealthy for all of us if we don't. And the way we've been talking about this is a much more productive way than the alternative, which is a conversation about, you know, food banks and what's, do they give out the right food or not? I mean, it's a real shame that we have any food banks at all in this country. They are merely a stopgap. They are merely the final, you know, possibility for food when all else has run out. Right. And so it's not about food banks. It's about our public policy around whether or not and how we think it's important to be supportive to those who most need it. That's the issue, not about how food banks are run.
I thank you for bringing that to our attention, and I'm impressed that you decided to participate in this, despite that you live in one of the better parts of Toronto. You also are a co-founder of a charity of your own, aren't you?
Yes, of Samara.
What is Samara?
Samara is a very small Canadian charity that I co-founded a couple of years ago with my colleague Allison Lote, and our purpose is to increase the awareness of Canadians and the interest in Canadians in participating in sort of the public policy development. So we're looking at citizen engagement, at public affairs journalism, and political leadership. This is all out of the view that public policy matters, and if we get it right, it's great, and if we get it wrong, it's terrible, and that we have to pay attention to sort of communal solutions, or common solutions, in the village green, if you will, and not merely rely on individualized actions separately, one from each other. So basically that public policy matters, and we should care about politics and policy.
I appreciate that. Is there a website that the listener can go to?
If you Google Samara or Samara Canada, you get it there.
Okay.
Great.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Super. See ya.
You've been listening to Michael McMillan, co-founder of charity Samara Canada and former executive chair Alliance Atlantis Media, with his experience of eating from a food hamper from the Stop Community Food Center in Toronto, which lasted 4 days, although as an experienced cook, he'd hoped to make it last for seven, as part of the Stop's Do the Math program to show people how long the $590 available on Ontario Works lasts once you pay the rent. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. Recall that these are not the articles that we read to you. These are excerpts or abbreviations of the articles for which you'll consult the newspapers that we mention during the broadcast. Beginning with The Star, this week, Teresa Boyle, health reporter, shrink Ontario MD's pay cost-saving report suggests. The province should overhaul the way doctors are paid so that the profession gets a smaller chunk of healthcare funding, says a coalition of healthcare providers. The bold recommendation is a report released Thursday that calls for major changes to Ontario's health system to save billions of taxpayer dollars. The report, titled Bending the Cost Curve, was produced by the Ontario Hospital Association, the Ontario Association of Community Care Access Centers, and the Ontario Federation of Community Mental Health and Addiction Programs. An advanced copy obtained by The Star notes that Ontario spends disproportionately more on physicians than other provinces. Last year, physician expenditure in Ontario was $842 per capita, compared with $675 per capita in other provinces. Ontario would save $2.2 billion a year if its spending was in line with other provinces. And from The Spectator, also this week, Joanna Frickditch. Does Ontario spend too much on doctors? It's ludicrous for hospitals to suggest Ontario spends too much per capita on doctors, says a Hamilton health policy expert. Wayne Taylor, professor of health services management at McMaster University, slammed a report recommending the province cut health care costs by reforming doctors' pay. Taylor says per capita spending is a terrible way to compare Ontario to other provinces because more of Canada's best and brightest researchers and physicians work here. We've got more of the highly specialized physicians and surgeons in Ontario, said Taylor. Of course it's going to be higher. That's not a bad thing. These doctors serve the entire country. Taylor said reforming doctors' pay could worsen an already bad doctor shortage that has left 40,000 Hamiltonians without a family physician.
Taylor expects to see more reports like this, pitting one area of the healthcare system against another, since the Ontario government made it clear it plans to curb healthcare's rising costs. Ontario's doctors have already shot back, calling the report misleading and maligning. A statement by Ontario Medical Association President Dr. Suzanne Strasberg suggested hospitals are out of touch and, once again, putting dollars before quality patient care. Locally, the head of Hamilton's Academy of Medicine expressed concern about the report. "We have to put more resources in this area, not less," said Academy President Dr. Richard Titus. He said better management of chronic disease and creating electronic medical records would go much further to cutting healthcare costs. The report also suggested other ways to save healthcare costs by improving home care, palliative care, mental health and addiction services, and management of chronic disease. And again from the Star, later this week, Rob Ferguson, the Queen's Park Bureau. "Minister rules out battle with MDs on pay. Says she'll keep focus on reducing drug costs. Ontario has no plan right now to do battle with doctors over how much they're paid," Health Minister Deb Matthews said Thursday, following a new report suggesting the province spends more on physicians than other provinces. The report, looking at options to trim fast-growing health costs, put doctors' pay in the crosshairs, and senior Liberal insider told the Star Matthews' tough stance in the fight with pharmacists over drug reforms is intended to send out a clear message to other players in the healthcare system as well. Matthews said she's now focused on battling pharmacies and drugstore chains angry over the government's plan to force down the cost of generic drugs by 50%, but noted Medicare is at risk if the rise in health costs is not curbed. "We're going to have to make changes," said Matthews, who notes health care will eat up 70 cents of every dollar the government spends within 12 years if current trends persist. "This is not part of our plan right now," she added when asked if doctors can expect pay curbs when their contract is up in 2012. Matthew said the current deal with the Ontario Medical Association on pay for doctors is something we will honor. And from the Star, last week, Jim Coyle. "What the pharmacy chains probably should have done before launching their Scud missiles at Health Minister Deb Matthews in the war over Ontario's proposed prescription drug reforms was to have given time to the independent drugstores and pharmacy students to make their case. As Kitchener pharmacist Brian Hasty said in an email, it's all too easy to make villains of big generic drug companies, faceless big box stores, and kickback deals. Hasty and his wife own a small retail pharmacy. Because his business is relatively new, he takes home less," he said, "than any staff pharmacist at a chain store. I have accepted that because I enjoy what I do," he said, "looking forward to the day when my salary is comparable to the market and I can afford to take the occasional vacation. Right now, my future is looking pretty bleak. While I'm willing to wait and see just where the chips fall, I have serious doubts that my business will be able to survive these funding cuts. The stores that will be left won't be pharmacies anymore. They will be prescription factories." Deepan Kalaria, a pharmacist at Central Medical Pharmacy on Sherbourne Street, said the patients who rely on pharmacists the most, quote, "have the least voice in our ever unforgiving society. Stop for a moment and ask the 85-year-old lady living on her own, trying to manage a dozen medications, how easy it is for her to speak to a doctor when she forgets which pills are for which condition. Take a walk down a poor city street where a paranoid schizophrenic has lost his medication and cannot see his physician for a week. Stop a mother of a child with cystic fibrosis leaving the hospital for sick children with a laundry list of medication and ask her how her pharmacist helps ease the burden of caring for a sick child. Tragically, these people are too busy being sick or taking care of the ill themselves to be heard." Vicky Luo, a first-year pharmacy student at the U of T, said students are alarmed at Shoppers Drug Mart's decision to cut summer intern positions. Sarab Patel, a second-year pharmacy student and vice president of the School of Pharmacy Students at the University of Waterloo, said the placements in her faculty's co-op program are perhaps the most important component of pharmacy education. "Tuition fees for pharmacy are exceptionally high in Ontario, and in order to sustain our education, we need the summer jobs co-placements."
From Siraj Khan, also a second-year pharmacy student at Waterloo, came the observation that much will be lost to patients because it's the willingness to listen and talk to a patient about their issues that sets pharmacists apart. In the public relations war now raging, the chains might have been best advised to let little pharma talk. And from the Globe and Mail's letters section, pharmacy wars. This from Monday, April 12th. Ontario's most vulnerable patients, seniors, and the chronically ill will have their health care services seriously compromised by this legislation. Instead of being able to rely on their pharmacists to provide the frontline health care services they need, they may now be forced to make a doctor's appointment or go to the hospital. On average, those cuts represent approximately $300,000 to each and every pharmacy, money that pharmacists now spend on staff, hours of operation, and the one-on-one services they offer their patients. There is just no way to sustain the level of service we offer today with more than $250,000 cut from bottom lines. Although the government would have you believe that the cuts will only affect big chains, more than half of Ontario pharmacies are owner-operated, and these cuts will have a direct and severe impact on the neighbourhood health care they deliver. That from Dean Miller, the chair of the Ontario Pharmacists Association. And from a letter by Richard Granville of Ajax, Ontario. The dispensing fee paid for the provision of prescription services under the Ontario Drug Benefit Program has increased by 56 cents over the past 21 years. The system of professional allowances was approved as a way to remunerate pharmacists appropriately while avoiding the politically difficult move of increasing the dispensing fee. Without these allowances, most pharmacies would have been out of business years ago. If they're removed without adjusting the dispensing fee, there will be no reason for Ontario pharmacists to continue providing online services to Ontario Drug Benefit Plan recipients. The majority will likely withdraw from their contract with Ontario Drug Benefits. Seniors and welfare recipients would then be faced with paying cash for their medications and attempting to get reimbursed directly by the Ontario Drug Benefit Plan. This would effectively collapse the drug distribution system. Political brinkmanship may look sexy to the public now, but dark times are ahead. And by Adam Radwanski in the Globe and Mail, Friday, April 9th. Health politics. Ontario's fight with pharmacies will turn national. Other health ministers probably won't envy Deb Matthews the long and bruising public relations battle she lengthened this week with pharmacists as she aims to take away their professional allowances, the rebates paid by generic pharmaceutical manufacturers in return for selling their products, which account for most of drugstores' profits. But they will look jealously upon the much lower prices that Ontarians will consequently pay for their prescriptions, which are projected to provide both public and private drug plans with hundreds of millions of dollars in annual savings. There is no way that provinces paying about 50% of the equivalent brand price for generic drugs will stand idly by as Ontario winds up paying only 25%. And what's especially alarming for pharmacies is that it's the two next biggest provinces that are best positioned to lower their prices. In Quebec, drug manufacturers' listing agreements with the government require them to match whatever the lowest price is elsewhere in Canada, so it will only be a matter of months after the prices are cut in half in Ontario before the same thing happens in its neighboring province. In British Columbia, the government is in negotiations with industry representatives to replace an interim agreement that will expire this summer. In response to a request for an update, its Ministry of Health Services issued a statement asserting that, quote, "We aim to achieve significant savings through these negotiations and are determined to limit the ever-growing cost of generic prescription drugs," unquote. It also stated somewhat ominously that it will take unilateral action if there is no satisfactory agreement by the end of June. Drugstores can at least take solace in the unlikelihood that their fourth largest market will act very aggressively. Still in the midst of implementing much milder pharmacy reforms of its own, which will put generic prices only slightly below 50% of the brand, Alberta is not generally expected to break course in the foreseeable future. The pain might not be as bad elsewhere because as of now there are no indications that anyone else plans to formally do away with the professional allowances. Quebec might just maintain the current cap, which limits the allowances to 20% of generic drug sale price. and BC has previously indicated little interest in tightly controlling the commercial relationship between manufacturers and retailers, so it doesn't have a cap at all. But the people who dispense drugs tend to make more sympathetic victims than the people who manufacture them, so it's pharmacists who are already being heard in Ontario. The prospect that their battle could become a national one promises to make their voices even louder. And from last week's Toronto Star, Ontarians face 8% hike in hydro bills. Boost in electricity prices announced for May 1st as Energy Minister calls rise in off-peak rate curious. By John Spears, business reporter. The vast majority of Ontarians face sharply higher power costs after the province's Energy Board raised the regulated price of electricity by 12% effective May the 1st. Opposition politicians immediately accused the Liberal government of a backdoor energy tax grab. The jump in the price of electricity was announced by the Ontario Energy Board, which sets rates for consumers who do not have fixed-price contracts. The Energy Board said the increase in the regulated price of power will add $7.60 a month, or 8%, to the overall bill of a typical householder who uses 800 kilowatt hours a month. While the energy portion of the bill goes up 12%, the costs of delivering power and other administrative charges don't change, so the overall increase in the bill is 8%. Consumers now pay 5.8 cents a kilowatt hour for the first 600 kilowatt hours they use each month in the summer, or the first 1,000 kilowatt hours in the winter. Starting May 1st, that price rises to 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Beyond those seasonal thresholds, consumers now pay 6.7 cents a kilowatt hour. Starting May 1st, they'll pay 7.5 cents. The price increase doesn't stop there. Many consumers are now being switched to time-of-use rates, which charge more for power used during peak periods and less for power used during off-peak periods, such as weekends and after 9 p.m. The new price schedule will boost the off-peak rate to 5.3 cents a kilowatt hour from 4.4 cents, a hike of 20%, while the peak rate rises to 9.9 cents from 9.3 cents. The mid-peak rate remains frozen at 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Energy consultant Bruce Sharp estimated that translates into an overall increase of 9.5% for a typical consumer. Energy Minister Brad Duguid told the Star he's watching the jump in the off-peak rate very carefully. Low off-peak rates are supposed to encourage consumers to shift some of their energy use to times when the power system isn't under stress. I thought it was curious, he said. I would want to ensure that it does not indeed impact any of our efforts to shift use. Part of the increase is due to the Energy Board allowing utilities to earn a higher return on their equity. Judy Gervin, Energy Advisor for the Consumers Council of Canada, questioned why a municipality like the City of Toronto should be using its electric utility to boost profits by increasing power rates. The city last year received $70.1 million in interest and dividend payments from Toronto Hydro. 11% of consumers have signed fixed-price contracts with energy retailers, but they don't escape higher prices either. They are subject to a separate fee, quaintly called the provincial benefit. It used to add about 1 cent per kilowatt-hour to a customer's bill, but it is adjusted monthly and in recent months has been mostly in the 3 cent to 4 cent range. Starting July 1st, all consumers will also pay the harmonized sales tax on their power bills, adding another 8% to the total. Conservative energy critic John Jakubowski ripped into the Liberals in the legislature. The market price for electricity is at historic lows, but the McGuinty Liberals have added so many regulatory increases, taxes, and fees that Ontario families, seniors, and businesses now see their electricity bills at historic highs, he said. Satinder Chira of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business said high energy prices are increasing concern for his members. We're not giving our ratepayers the ability to manage their costs, he added. Many small businesses now being subjected to time-of-use rates can't switch their business hours to take advantage of low nighttime rates, he said. Duguid acknowledged in the legislature that prices will rise. And now let's take a break. Before we get back to what must surely seem like all bad news all the time, we have Jimmy Thackeray and Monkey.
Don't come to me with your money, baby. I got problems of my own. Don't come to me with your money, baby.
I got problems in my home. Don't come to me with your money, baby. I got problems in my home. Well, times are good, baby. You wouldn't call me on the phone.
Toronto Star again. Landlords call province's HST measures unfair. By Laurie Monsebraten and Rob Ferguson, staff reporters. Owners say they'll have to cut back maintenance repairs to absorb tax. Landlords say the McGuinty government is duping Ontario's 1.3 million tenant households by saying measures introduced Monday will protect them from the HST. And by refusing to help landlords absorb the harmonized sales tax, the province will force them to cut back on badly needed maintenance and repairs, they added. The government has done nothing to protect tenants from the HST, said Vince Brescia, president of the Federation of Rental Housing Providers of Ontario, or FRPO. All they have done is kick landlords. With no assistance and no way to pass on costs, landlords will have no option but to slash repairs and maintenance, he added in an interview. As The Star reported, Monday the Liberal government is closing a loophole in rent regulations that would have allowed landlords to apply for above-guideline rent increases based on the new 13% tax on utilities that takes effect in July. Instead, the new HST costs for utilities will be reflected in rent only as they affect the Consumer Price Index, which the province uses to calculate the annual rent increase guideline. In addition to the new rental protection, almost 3 million low-income Ontario families will receive new permanent sales tax credit of up to $260 for each adult and child per year. A new property tax credit will provide another $270 million in tax relief to low- and middle-income homeowners and tenants. Premier Dalton McGuinty said the government wants to ensure we protect renters from any costs associated with the HST on energy, and being fair to landlords, they can factor those costs in over time through the Consumer Price Index, which is accounted for on an annual basis. Landlords would also be able to recoup their costs in rents they set for new tenants, ministry officials said. But the CPI-based rent guideline for next year is forecast to be just 0.5%, Brescia said, making it impossible for landlords to cover the HST costs. In addition to utilities, the new tax will apply to other previously exempt costs, such as maintenance, property management, and renovation contracts, which will boost landlords' costs by about 5%, he said. With inflation running at about 2%, Brescia said landlords' costs will rise by up to 7% next year. How is a business supposed to survive if it can't pass on its costs, he asked. And from the Hamilton Spectator, Friday, April 16th, Police Need More Mental Health Training Conference Hears, by Denise Davey. 5 years ago, Kelly Crago's 28-year-old brother attacked and killed their parents, then wrapped up their bodies and put them in the basement of their Mississauga home. He was later charged and found not criminally responsible because of his mental illness. The court heard Andrew was a paranoid schizophrenic who believed his parents had been killed and replaced by aliens. Craigo told her chilling story to a room full of police officers in Hamilton as a warning of what can happen when police aren't trained on mental health issues. Her parents had tried for years to get help for their son and call police with their concerns, but to no avail. Craigo believes if officers had been educated about mental health problems, they would have responded differently. More than 170 police officers in Hamilton have been through a specialized training program run by the Crisis Outreach and Support Team, COAST, a 24-hour crisis outreach program. Crisis intervention training teaches them how to de-escalate a situation when a person is in an agitated and aggressive state as a result of their mental illness. This mid-April's first national CIT conference brought together officers and mental health workers from across Canada to talk about the importance of training police officers on mental health issues. Retired Lieutenant Mike Woody, president of CIT International from Ohio, told the crowd CIT training is more important than first aid training. Coast mental health worker Sarah Burtonshaw said the team receives more than 15,000 calls a year. From the Globe, James Keller in Vancouver. RCMP used excessive force against disabled son, father, an ex-policeman. The father of a mentally challenged man who was taken down at gunpoint after he was seen with what turned out to be a toy gun says he welcomes an RCMP investigation into officers' use of force. The RCMP announced an internal investigation after the family raised concerns about how Mounties confronted 49-year-old Rodney Moffat in Canal, BC on March 29th. Someone called 911 after spotting Moffat near a high school with what appeared to be a gun sticking out of his pocket. RCMP officers arrived soon after and with guns drawn took Mr. Moffat to the ground. His father said, "I think it was very excessive," said Carl Moffat, a 73-year-old former police officer from Windsor, Ontario, in an interview from his home just outside of Canal, about 650 kilometers northeast of Vancouver. Moffat said his son was born hydrocephalic with what is known as water on the brain, and he's mentally disabled. All they had to do was look at him. Rodney's small in stature, he's weak, he has a staggered walk and terrible balance. He cooperated, everything they told him to do, he did. There was just no need for such violence. The gun turned out to be a futuristic-looking children's toy. Carl said the gun is considerably larger than a handgun, colored silver and orange with lights that glow when the trigger is pulled. Rodney no longer had the toy with him when police arrived. Carl Moffat said he doesn't want to tar the entire police force with his complaint, but it's clear to him that mistakes were made in this case, and he wants to know why. "I don't want to hold the RCMP up to such heavy public criticism, but they've got a hard job, and they're a good police department," he said, "but mistakes happen, and what happened to Rodney wasn't right. And if they're going to hold an investigation into this and get down to the problem, I just welcome that wholeheartedly, and I'll cooperate in any way I can." And from the Globe and Mail, Friday, April 9th, by Mark Hume in Vancouver. Top court rejects BC Attorney General's appeal of ruling prosecutors required to testify at inquiry. A decision by the Supreme Court of Canada has cleared the way for resumption of a public inquiry into the death of Frank Paul, a homeless man who died from hypothermia after being dumped in an alley by Vancouver police. The court rejected an application by the Attorney General of British Columbia to appeal a BC Supreme Court ruling that said Crown prosecutors could be compelled to testify at the inquiry. Neil McKenzie, Communications Counsel for the BC Criminal Justice Branch, said the Supreme Court decision means Crown prosecutors will now have to testify. Retired BC Supreme Court Justice William Davies, the head of the inquiry, wanted prosecutors to explain why charges were not laid against the Vancouver police officers who had dragged Mr. Paul out of jail and left him in an alley on a cold December night in 1998. Mr. Paul, who was severely intoxicated and unable to walk, was found dead the next morning where he'd been left. The commission heard there were five reviews by Crown prosecutors before a decision was made not to lay charges. But when Mr. Davies sought details, the criminal justice branch said prosecutors didn't have to testify because they had immunity. The dispute went to court, and in July 2008, BC Supreme Court Justice Thomas Melnick ruled the inquiry's terms of reference, which included examining the procedures of the criminal justice branch, gave Mr. Davies the authority to call prosecutors. In my view, there is no principled reason why a prosecutor from the CJB who receives a notice to appear before the commissioner should be treated any differently than any other participant in the inquiry, Judge Melnick ruled. The BC government sought to appeal that ruling, but the Supreme Court of Canada decision serves an endorsement of Judge Melnick's decision. In an interim report, Mr. Davies said Vancouver police failed to adequately investigate Frank Paul's death. The evidence requires me to conclude that despite the service of many fine and diligent professionals, our systems of justice and social service ultimately failed Frank Paul. And now an announcement, a protest rally at Queen's Park. In July 2009, the Ontario Child Benefit was increased to $92. But most of this increase was clawed back from families on social assistance by reducing the basic needs portion of the parents' benefits. Worst hit by this clawback were parents with one child age 13. These families are now receiving only $1 per month more than in 2008. Sponsored by the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits in Hamilton, the Social Action Committee, the Ontario Association of Social Workers from Hamilton, and the 25 and 5 in Hamilton. Tuesday, April 27th, 2010, 8:45 a.m. For all you early birds, the buses leave Hamilton at Fortino's Plaza, Dundurn Street between King and Main, the north end at King, leaving Toronto at approximately 1 p.m. Light lunch provided. Please register with Nona Clark, 905-522-1148, extension 319. Leave a message with your name and number. That's 522-1148, extension 319, or email nonaclark2005@hotmail.com. And that's all the news for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. You can be sure there will be more. And now, to take us out, Alan Jackson made this popular. This version is Jimmy Thackeray's Mercury Blues.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.